Okay, colleagues, members of the public, today is May 6, 2015. This is the Senate Committee on Workforce, and we are here to hear a couple of bills, and they should be quite interesting. So, and I see we have some people who will be testifying, so that's great. So let's start off with House Bill 2007A, and so I'll open the public hearing on this bill, House Bill 2007A, and Representative Jessica Vega-Peterson will be presenting it to us, but Matt, why don't you give us a little introduction, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2007A makes for disciplinary action against employees who inquire about or disclose wage information as an unlawful business employment practice and provides employees with a private right of action and creates a few exceptions. There were no fiscal impacts or revenue impacts when it came through the House.
Okay, thank you, Matt. Representative, welcome.
Thank you.
Great to see you again.
It's great to be here again. Thank you, Chair Denbrough and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Vega-Peterson. I'm the state representative for House District 47 in East Portland. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2007. So this is a bill that I spoke in support of when it was in the Business and Labor Committee in the House, and also on March 3rd when I carried this bill on the floor of the House. And I'm glad to continue supporting this bill here in this committee today. This bill is a very positive step in Oregon in terms of addressing the problems of wage inequality that we have. We know that pay inequality is still a problem for many women in this state. In fact, when you look at the problems of pay inequality, where women are on average only making 77 cents per hour compared to men, this is something that we know exists, and it's actually something that, according to the Women's Policy Research, this pay gap will not be solved on its own without action on our part until 2056. Now, I'm a mother of a 7-year-old daughter, which means that she will be older than I am before this problem fix if we don't take any action on that. And that's why we need bills like House Bill 2007. We know that the wage gap hits working mothers and their families especially hard. We know that right now 2/3 of women are serving as the primary or co-breadwinners for their family. But this affects women at all ages or at all levels of the wage spectrum, from low-income wage earners to high-income earners. In fact, even at the highest levels in high-income categories where women actually outnumber men, they still only earn 63 cents on the dollar for their male counterparts. With House Bill 2007, we strengthen our equal pay laws so that if an employee decides to share information about their salary with their coworkers, they won't be able to suffer retaliation at the hands of their employer. We know that wage transparency is a proven strategy for addressing the wage gap, and there's actually research done that proves that this is something that's actually beneficial to employers, too. In businesses where they do have wage transparency policies, businesses have improved staff retention rates, increased workplace efficiency and worker retention, and there's also greater trust between employers and employees. So we know that this is an issue. We know that it is something that we can address by having more pay transparency. So, and this is something that we can take steps to address an issue that's actually affecting workers and harming workers. Lily Ledbetter, who has a national, as you know, the national law named after her, the reason that she wasn't able to address the issue is because she didn't know that the wage gap, the discrimination was happening, and she didn't find out until it was too late to do anything about it. And this is exactly the problem that House Bill 2007 seeks to address. So I urge your support of this bill, and I hope that you will pass it out of the committee and onto the floor. Thank you.
Senator.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, fellow members of the Senate Workforce Committee. For the record, my name is Diane Rosenbaum, State Senator for Senate District 21 in Inner Southeast Portland, Milwaukee, and Oak Grove in Clackamas County. And my background has a little relevance to this issue. Prior to being elected, I served as the chair of the Oregon Commission for Women from 1993 to 1998. And as a legislator, I have focused on joining workforce issues and women's issues in my role as co-chair of the Oregon Women's Health and Wellness Alliance and my current position as Senate Majority Leader. And I am proud to join my colleague here as the Senate Chief Sponsor of House Bill 2007, because I have personally seen our families, our communities, and our economy flourish when working Oregonians have more chances to get ahead, not just get by. Right now, we know that we have laws on the books that require equal pay, and yet we still have this gap. In fact, just a couple of weeks ago, we passed the day in the year that women would have had to work that much longer into April, in fact, in order to earn what their male counterparts had earned the previous year. And for minority women, this gap is even greater. So despite the laws on the books, we're failing to ensure that women are receiving comparable wages for positions requiring comparable skills, background, education, and experience. And the good news is that House Bill 2007 will alleviate persistent gender-based disparities and propel Oregon forward by ensuring that no worker fears retaliation from their employer for initiating conversations about wages. You've already heard that two-thirds of working women in Oregon are the primary or co-breadwinners in their families, and right now they're taking home less income and are less likely to earn wage raises and promotions. They earn fewer retirement benefits and accumulate lower lifetime wealth. So this just isn't a problem paycheck to paycheck, but it has a lifelong consequence for these women workers who are accumulating less in every way. And pay inequality not only impacts these women, but it also directly impacts their children and other adults who are dependent on their incomes. As we all know in this day and age, it's a family income that Oregonians rely on. Oregon does not stand to benefit from these persistent economic insecurities like pay inequality. It's necessary to not only acknowledge the importance of securing for working women the protections to speak openly and transparently about their wages, we also need to enact policy that ensures those protections. Our House Bill 2007 would prohibit retaliation against Oregon's working women and employees who discuss pay practices and salaries. I truly appreciate the hard work that has gone into crafting these bills. Thanks to our Labor Commissioner Brad Avakian and members of the Civil Rights Council, they have put in a huge amount of time dedicated to exploring this important issue. Chair Dembro and committee members, I urge you to fulfill the promise of equal pay in Oregon by voting in support of House Bill 2007. Oregon's working women, their families, and our communities deserve a fair shot at a fair wage, and we must act now to ensure that. I began my working career almost 40 years ago, and I know that we have made significant progress toward equal pay. But colleagues, there is still work to do. That's why I'm proud to be a chief sponsor and co-sponsor with Representative Edgar Peterson of House Bill 2007. I look forward to working with each of you this session to promote policies that work for our working Oregonians. Thank you very much, Mr. President. I think we're both happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Thank you both for bringing this to us. Questions, colleagues? Okay, thank you both very
thank
much
you.
For coming. Okay, I'm going to call up Tim Bernasek and Betsy Earls, please.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls appearing on behalf of Associated Oregon Industries. And I think you've already had a pretty good overview of what Senate Bill 2007 does. Basically, the bill makes it an unlawful employment practice for employers to discharge, demote, suspend, discriminate, or retaliate against an employee because that employee has inquired about, discussed, or disclosed in any manner their own wages or discussed the wages of another employee or made a charge, filed a complaint, any of those kind of whistleblower things related to talking about their wages. And there are a couple reasons that we are concerned about this bill in particular. I know there's been a great deal of conversation around it from the proponents about how this is an equal pay measure. We see it as much broader than that, and for that reason, very concerning. The first concern we have is that the phrase inquired about, discussed, or disclosed in any manner sets an extremely low bar for an employee to have to prove if they end up filing an employment action, an action for employment discrimination against their employer. Any comment made in the course of an ordinary day, such as I'm worth more than this or I don't get paid enough to do this job, which I think we all in this building have felt probably recently, will suddenly become grounds. Could provide potentially grounds for retaliation complaints. There are a couple other things I wanted to bring to your attention. Most discrimination and retaliation statutes already include language that defines the specifics of what employers cannot do around conversations such as this. For example, 659A199 covers conversations about promotion, compensation, or other conditions, terms, and privileges of employment. Those conversations are protected. With regard to formal employee complaints about wages, these conversations would be considered oppositional activity, which is already protected by another statute, ORS 659A.030, and would be considered an internal complaint, which is something that's protected already by federal law. If you're providing an additional avenue for employees to sue their employers, that means that even if the employers found not to have violated the law, they still have spent the time and the money to go through the pretrial process, hire an attorney, go through potential depositions and discovery, which can run into the thousands of dollars, even if they never end up at trial, to defend themselves in circuit court. No employer wants to have to spend this kind of money, but especially to smaller employers, it can make the difference between having a viable year and one where they are close to having to close their doors. So I think in summary, AOI objects to House Bill 2007, not only because it sets that bar low for discrimination suits, but because we haven't seen a lot of widespread evidence of problems about conversations about wages and compensation that would justify adding a new layer of regulation in an area where there's already quite a bit of protection. Adding such new regulations and penalties without that solid justification is not going to make Oregon a better place to work. Basically, what it will do is make it a less inviting place for employers to set up shop.
Thanks, Betsy. Tim, welcome back.
Thank you. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tim Bernasek. I'm an attorney at the Dunn-Carney Law Firm in Portland. I'm here representing the Oregon Farm Bureau today, also concerned about House Bill 2007. And I won't reiterate the issues that Ms. Earls mentioned. I think we generally agree with everything that she said. I just want to, I guess, point out a few additional items. For most employees in the agricultural community, wage transparency is generally not an issue, which I understand is one of the big concerns that the proponents have of this bill. You know, most farm workers, they're paid an hourly rate or a piece rate that is just sort of generally available for everybody, so everybody knows what workers make. Obviously, different employment settings are different. So I think our concern stems, and again, what Mr. Earls talked about is just sort of the breadth of what this bill really does do and the potential chill it would have on employee and employer communications about wages. Generally, these are things that employers, particularly responsible employers, want to promote. That, you know, if employees, if you have concerns about what you're being paid, come bring it to my attention. Let's talk about it. Doesn't mean I necessarily can fix it, but let's have that discussion. And I think that by creating a new cause of action for employees who, you know, may have raised concerns about their wages and then later are discharged or have some sort of employment action related to some wholly different conduct, it opens the door for this to be yet one more claim against that employer when a lawsuit goes forward. And The gist of most employment claims, it's not usually the amount that's at issue is the real problem. It's really the attorney fees that are involved. And when we add more and more claims, more and more exposure for employers, it does at times, particularly in an agricultural setting where margins can be so very narrow, can be the difference between whether you stay in business or you don't. And so I just wanted to reiterate that concern. And then also want to talk about one other area that affected employees do, where this is potentially redundant, and that is the Oregon statutes on concerted activity have been read by Oregon courts, particularly ORS Chapter 662, that expresses Oregon's public policy in support of workers engaging in concerted activity, so speaking amongst themselves about wages and bringing those issues forward. Have been found that if employers have in fact discharged employees for engaging in that activity, they are susceptible to a wrongful discharge claim in under Oregon's common law. So, in addition to all of the statutory sites that Ms. Earls represented, there is this other body of law that's out there, and so it just seems to us when you balance the law that's already there versus the chilling effect that this bill would have on good employee-employer communications, it seems like to us that the balance would be in the favor of not passing this legislation and maybe educating and informing, making sure employees are aware of what rights currently do exist so that healthy communication in the workforce does occur.
Okay, thank you, Tim. Questions? I have one. I don't have the bill in front of me. My computer has decided it needs its power cord. you know, in terms of that chilling effect, I mean, the bill is really designed to, you know, to remove the threat of discipline for employees who compare notes, as it were, about their pay. I mean, I think that's the intent of it. But how does it get in the way of employers and employees communicating about the wages?
I can take the first crack, and I think we probably both have comments about it. But it has a chilling effect on employer conversations, tends to have that kind of effect. Because the bar for bringing a discrimination claim under this particular bill is so low that it would be fairly easy for an employee to, you know, have a negative experience at work with their employer and look back a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and say, oh, they did that because, you know, because I had that conversation with them a few weeks ago.
But how would they even know? How would the employer even know that you had that, you know, the employees had had that conversation?
This covers employee to employee and employee to employer. And I think that is probably the chilling effect that Mr. Bernasek is talking about, is employer to employee.
Yeah, Chair Denver, if I can just elaborate it, I think it's in Section 2.1A where it talks about, you know, that it sets it up in any sort of discriminatory action because the employee has inquired about, discussed, or disclosed in any manner the wages of the employee or of another employee. So that's whether it's amongst employees or talk to the employer about their wages, which, again, I think responsible employers welcome discussions with, you know, we've got a concern, well, here's why we pay this, here's what why we're doing. These are good conversations to have. But if it opens us up to later, if we have to take a some sort of employment action against that employee for a wholly unrelated matter, but yet this conversation has occurred, it chills an employer's. You may make the decision that, no, I don't want to talk about that. I don't want there to be anywhere in the record that we've had discussions about wages for fear of a potential legal liability.
Right. But, I mean, employees should be able to, you know, if they feel they deserve higher pay, they should be able to ask that of the employer, right? And then, but the employer should not then discipline them for making that request. You would agree with that, right?
Chair Denbrough, yeah, I agree, and I guess I don't, in my practice, I just don't see that happening very often. In fact, what I see oftentimes is that these are discussions that are promoted. In fact, in the agricultural workforce, it happens all the time. In piece rate, you may, first picking of berries, you've got a lot of fruit on, maybe we pay 45 cents, but as we get to second and third pickings, the employees will often come to the supervisor and say, hey, look, this isn't going to work. We got to bump this up or we're out of here. So all of a sudden you bump it up to 60 cents. That's good. I mean, that's healthy. We want to keep those workers there. But when we add language like it's in House Bill 2007, it creates concern amongst those of us that are advising employers that, well, yeah, okay, you may have that particular worker, you may have to discipline them downward for something wholly unrelated, but if they've got on evidence that they talked to you about wages, they're going to claim it was because we had the audacity to raise a concern about wages, and you may prevail, but you've got to litigate that claim, and that's what is so problematic in this is just another example, but just these employment, new employment claims generally, why it's such a problem for employers is it's oftentimes not the cost of the individual damage amount, but it's hiring the lawyers and having to defend all this.
But don't you think a disgruntled worker could always find something to bring a suit about?
If I could take a crack at that, Mr. Chair, I think that that's absolutely true. I think the thing that concerns us about this particular bill is that the standard of proof that an employee would have to meet to bring that lawsuit is lower than some of the other statutes I've mentioned to you, and therefore it's easier to do so.
Thank you. Okay, thank you both very much. Okay, Paloma Sparks and Trish Garner are next, please.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Paloma Sparks with Bureau of Labor and Industries. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2007. In 2011, Commissioner Brad Avakian directed the Oregon Council on Civil Rights to study the issue of pay inequality in Oregon. In 2013, the legislature passed Senate Bill 744, directing Boley and the council to continue to study the issue and make recommendations to the Oregon legislature. In 2014, the council produced the Pay Inequality in Oregon report. The report finds that women in Oregon still make just 79 cents on the dollar for every dollar earned by a man. Pay inequality affects women's financial stability throughout their earning lives. Women continue to take home less income, are less likely to earn raises and promotions at the same pace, earn fewer retirement benefits, and accumulate lower lifetime wealth. At the same time, two-thirds of working women are the primary or co-breadwinners in their family. This affects families across Oregon. A significant barrier to a worker's ability to advocate for equal pay is when there are chilling effects on their ability to communicate about pay raises. In addition, a lot of opponents of or people who have concerns about equal pay legislation will say, well, women just need to be better negotiators. Well, you can't be a better negotiator if you don't have the facts in front of you. Being able to communicate about this is important. Current law doesn't cover these sorts of activities. It doesn't protect workers who have conversations about their wages. There have been some statutes that have been cited. Those don't really cover what we're talking about here. Additionally, 662 is it's merely a policy statement that's in statute. It doesn't have any teeth. It doesn't have any Boley enforcement. And it's only been an interpretation made by the courts at this point. The council has recommended that Oregon pass a wage transparency law. This is one of the many recommendations that were in the report related to pay inequality in Oregon. We think that women need access to this information. There needs to be an open communication. If we're talking about a change in workplaces where this is no longer an issue, where you have workplaces where pay is open to the public, the gap is much smaller. The protection would not interfere with an employer's right to prohibit an employee who maintains pay records from keeping those confidential. This merely protects open communication among employees. The work by the council and Boley make it clear that this is a key to moving forward towards true equal pay. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Trish, welcome.
Thank you so much. Chair Dembrough and members of the committee, good afternoon. Yes, my name is Trish Garner. I represent AAUW of Oregon. That's American Association of University Women of Oregon, where we've been empowering the rights of women since 1881. I'm here to demonstrate, hopefully, how strongly AAUW of Oregon supports this legislation. We frankly can't comprehend the state continuing to approve whether explicitly or implicitly, a policy that prevents employees from understanding where they stand and opportunities for advancement which may lie ahead. Importantly, this legislation also benefits employers on the bottom line issues of greater efficiency and productivity. We're not necessarily asking that everyone's salaries be posted in the lunchroom and be bandied about casually about one's worth or otherwise, but transparency as to pay grades, levels, as well as the methodology for setting salaries and calculating raises would definitely have a transformative effect on the gender and race pay gap. Having salary transparency also pays off in employee recruitment and retention of top talent. I would also say, on a personal level, since I testified on behalf of this legislation in the House, I have conducted something of an informal survey. I have asked a variety of employees, cashiers, secretaries, nurses, healthcare professionals, do they know their peers, their fellow employees' salaries? No. And then, would it be appropriate to discuss these salaries or wages? And to a person, I, received something of a blank stare and a response that, well, I can't do that. I might be fired. Again, this prevents employees from understanding where they are and what, with additional effort, they can do to get ahead. This would benefit the women and families of Oregon. I strongly urge you to support this legislation. Thank you for the opportunity to address the issues, and if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Trish. Questions for this panel? Yes, Senator Knope.
Thank you. Paloma, in the bill it says that a bookkeeper can't disclose the information, but what if another employee in some way has access to that information, or the bookkeeper has talked to another employee? Can that employee just go out and put the salaries of all the office workers on Facebook or something like that? And would that be something that they couldn't be disciplined for under this bill?
Senator Knope, the language of the bill protects an employer's right to limit what somebody whose job it is to maintain that information from releasing information. So if somebody had access to the books but wasn't necessarily the person, that protection would still extend. So that person could still be disciplined for releasing information if it was their job to keep that information confidential.
But, Mr. Chair, can I follow up?
Yes, please.
I mean, small offices, bookkeepers making copies of checks and goes to answer the phone and somebody else comes to the copier and, here's what everybody's, here's the direct deposit for this month and here's what everybody's making. That person takes that and puts it on Facebook, and could they be, even though they didn't have necessarily a part in that, could they, in keeping that secret, could they be disciplined by the employer?
Chair Denbrough, Senator Knope, I don't believe that is the kind of activity that is protected under this bill. This is about being able to have open communication. Certainly the bookkeeper who left documents that were intended to be confidential on a copy machine would certainly be disciplined, I would imagine.
Okay.
Any other questions for this panel? Okay, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have Jael Wilson and Jan Meekums, please.
Good afternoon.
Welcome, Jael.
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jael Wilson, representing the Oregon State Chambers of Commerce. And we don't support House Bill 2007, but I want to kind of take you through a sequence why, just as an employer with a number of employees whom this would apply to, so I kind of look at it through that lens. Just as an employer, I look at almost every decision through a liability lens and sort of what's my liability for this particular decision. I've got you know, between 20 and 25 employees who are hourly. And the type of work they do means that we do have wage discussions at least twice a year. So that's, you know, 50 wage discussions plus those kind of discussions that kind of happen impromptu. I'd like to be paid more. And usually I welcome those discussions because it means they're invested in what we do, and the vast majority of the time it gives us an opportunity to talk about a pathway to doing the job better, moving up in responsibility, being paid more, and I enjoy those conversations typically. I can also say that I had to take three adverse employment actions in the last year, just had to terminate people for a cause, and those are bad, you know, those are decisions I don't like having to make, but the reality is there were wage discussions prior to those adverse employment actions in the near vicinity of those actions occurring. I do have significant concerns that I would have been liable, or at least it would have been on a demand letter, that those the terminations occurred at least in part because those discussions were had. And this is going to ensnare, I think, a lot of good employers who welcome those discussions, who want to have those discussions, but also, unfortunately, on occasion have to take adverse employment actions, that they will at least face the prospect of liability for those decisions under the auspices of this bill. And when it was talked about, you know, sort of a chilling effect on employer communications with regard to wages, I can't say that it would change, the passage of the bill would change what I do or how I do things initially. But I can tell you the first time I see that, you know, God forbid that there's a demand letter at some point in time that that is brought up, I promise you we'll change our practices with regard to wage discussions subsequent to that. So in that regard, I think that this bill may move us in a tough, in a direction that would be counterproductive to the intention of the bill if it is intended to open up wage discussions. I'm really concerned about Section 2.1A of the bill, particularly as it relates to discussing or disclosing in any manner the wages of the employee or of another employee. And the reason I bring that up is because sometimes people like to talk about other people's wages, and yet that other person had no intention of their wages being made public, talked about in any way, shape, or form. And I would be inclined to take disciplinary actions in those cases when the person whose wages are being talked about had no intention of having their wages made public or being talked about in any way, and it wasn't with their permission. And that's a trap that this bill falls into that I don't think is adequately addressed, because then you have another aggrieved employee who doesn't want to be part of this mix, and yet the person who talks about their wages publicly is suddenly protected under this law. And I think that that's a poor outcome, and I think it encourages bad behavior in the workplace. So those are just some of the cautionary things that I see in this bill, and for that reason, again, I think good employers are going to get snared in this law. This isn't a case where we're just going after bad actors. I think you're going to have employers who are willing to have wage discussions with their employees, even a lot of wage discussions with their employees, scale back those discussions if it means limiting their liability. And I don't think that that's really what we intend here. So thank you.
Thank you, Jan.
Hello. Good afternoon. Thank you, Senator Dembrough and members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak on this bill. For the record, my name is Jan Meekums. I'm the state director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business, representing about 7,000 small private businesses in the state of Oregon. We, too, are opposed to House Bill 2007 for all of the reasons mentioned by my previous peers who are opposed to the bill. I would like to, for the record, that we agree with equal pay, that men and women should be paid equally for equal work. We have no disagreement there. We also believe in open conversations. We and our small employers, particularly because they are, small employers, need to maintain a particularly open communication environment with their employees, because it's a smaller, more intimate group. And we feel that that Section 2A is very troublesome for us, that it does lay the groundwork for a litigious environment. I have a small business employer that said to me, I wake up every morning and the first thought I have is, how can I not be sued today? It's not how do I build my business, how do I employ more people, it's how do I stop from being sued, and that suit from the employee. Creating this law and adding an unlawful employment practice, another one to the list of unlawful employment practices, creates that kind of concern for small employers. As you've heard, one litigation can be enough to cause a small employer to have to shut their doors. And for that reason, we are opposed, again, not to the intent, but to the collateral damage that can be created by this law. Thank you.
Any questions? I guess, Jan, I would just say, you know, I'm thinking of your small business owner who's not sleeping out of the fear. This law isn't in place now, and she's already not sleeping. If we put this in, how is this going to make it worse?
Thank you, Senator Dembrough, and members of the committee. I appreciate that sentiment, and I can understand why you would ask that question. And for us, it's not any one bill. It's the accumulation. And we have, particularly this session, we have addressed many, many bills that have unlawful employment practice added to the statute. And so it just, instead of a few areas, and again, there is some controversy as to whether it's already covered in current statute, both state and federal or not, we believe it is. It's redundant and just adds another opportunity for a disgruntled employee to sue an employer.
Thank you.
Yes.
Just a question for both of you. So, or actually, JL, I'll ask you. So, you know, your concern was with the employee, you know, who comes to you and, you know, you have a salary discussion with them. But how about employees who discuss among themselves? I mean, is that something that you would prohibit? Or how do you feel about employers who have a practice of prohibiting employees from discussing salaries among themselves? Do you see any reason that should be a business practice?
Thank you, Chair Dembrough, members. For the record, I already said my name for the record. Most of the time, the employer doesn't know about it. I mean, let's be real. I don't know about it until someone usually wants to sort of take up the cause and be, I guess you could say, a squeaky wheel. I think it's foolish to assume that those conversations don't already take place. I would also say, Chair Dembrough, that I don't think most people really care to disclose their wages, and I don't think most people really care to share that information, and I don't think that a lot of people, I think for my employees, really don't care, as long as they feel like they're treated fairly and they have a good relationship with me as their boss and they feel relatively well taken care of. I don't think that that is a real top of mind concern for them, as long as they feel that they can come talk to me about it. And so I think it would be foolish for an employer to assume that those conversations aren't taking place already. Usually what happens is, and I'm just going to be frank with you, usually the cause is taken up by somebody who has, an axe to grind. And usually that person, I'm going to be frank, is usually somebody for whom you're probably going to terminate for another reason for cause anyways, because they'll... they'll for lack of performance, or they'll just poison the well so badly in your work environment that your other employees are coming to you and saying, we can't work with this person, and so you've got a larger issue. And that's usually how these things play out. But to answer your question directly, if people wanted to talk about their wages amongst themselves, I don't care. But I mostly don't know about it either, and I think it would be foolish to assume that it's not happening anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but do you know of any businesses that actually have policies saying that employees, employees can be disciplined for sharing, for discussing their salaries?
Thank you, Chair Dembrough. I don't know if there's disciplinary policies. I certainly know employers routinely have policies that typically prohibit the disclosure of wages. I don't know how they're enforced or what the disciplinary is. I just say most of the time, if it's people having conversations, you know, that happens in the milieu of the workplace. I mean, most it doesn't really. It happens, you know.
May I add a comment to that?
Please.
I think in some cases it's to protect the employee as much as it is the employer, because as has been mentioned, the employee does not want their compensation to be discussed. Mm-hmm. So it works both ways.
Yeah. Senator Knope.
Thank you, Chair Dembro. Can either of you articulate how this advances pay equity? Because I'm still trying to figure that part of the bill out.
Well, thank you, Chair Dembro and Senator Knope. I think the theory is that when people start to understand what each other are being paid, then you have more leverage in wage discussions, I assume. I view it through a lens of, I think it discourages wage discussions with the only person that really matters, which is the employer, because now they have a liability attached if they have that discussion and a subsequent adverse action is taken for any reason. And because the adverse action can be taken for any other reason, but it will still come back that, at least on a demand letter, that it in part was due to these conversations. So I understand the intention. I just don't agree that this bill gets us there. In fact, I think it's probably counterproductive.
Okay, thank you, both of you.
Thank you.
Okay, next is Kate Newhall and Arthur Towers, please.
Thank you, Chair Dembro and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall, representing Family Forward today. Glad to be here today offering testimony in support of House Bill 2007. Family Forward sees this as an important component of addressing pay inequality in Oregon. Equal pay for equal work is still a far cry off reality for many women. And wage discrimination takes many forms and can be seen across all industries and at all ages for working women. In 2015, women in Oregon are still being paid lower wages than men simply because they are women. And this has dire consequences for women and also for the families who rely on them. Mothers in particular are affected by the wage gap. They are now the primary or sole breadwinners in nearly 40% of families nationwide. Here in Oregon, there are 166,000 family households headed by women. And out of that, 56,000 of those family households are living below the federal poverty level. When women and mothers aren't earning equal pay for equal work, it's Oregon families that suffer. There is not just one policy or solution to solving the wage gap, but this is an important part of the solution. We have an opportunity this year to address some of the barriers that prevent why women don't get paid equally for their work. Paycheck transparency in the workplace allows all workers to talk about their pay with their coworkers without fear of being retaliated against. To Senator Dembro's point a little bit earlier, we have a national study, and it's actually cited in my written testimony, that found that 61% of private sector employees had been discouraged or are prohibited from discussing wage and salary information. When women and people of color do not know what their colleagues are earning, it's really difficult and probably impossible for them to know if they're not being paid equally for their equal work. Workers have to be able to ascertain what they are earning in a job, what their job position is relative to someone with the same skills, doing this with the same experience, that has the same responsibility. I think you've heard today that some of the main objections to this concept are the potential litigation costs. Well, just to counter that, right now women and families in Oregon are being shortchanged almost $10,000 each year, amounting to hundreds of thousands of dollars over a lifetime because of the pay gap. When more families are relying on a woman's paycheck for their livelihood, we have to address wage inequality and ensure the financial success and strength of our Oregon families. We see this as an important step forward in achieving equal pay for equal work and urge your support.
Thank you, Kate. Arthur.
For the record, my name is Arthur Towers, political director for Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. We submitted written testimony. I just wanted to register our support for the legislation. Don't have a lot to add beyond what's already been said, but really do appreciate the sponsors for bringing this bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Arthur. Questions for this panel? Okay, thank you both very much. Okay, is there anyone else that wants to speak to this bill? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2007, and I'll open our public hearing on House Bill 2600. Matt, you want to tell us about it?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2600 requires the continuation of group health insurance coverage for an employee on family leave. It came through the House committee with minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to call up Representative Smith Warner, who represents colleagues one of the two best House districts in the state.
Amen to that, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, for the record, my name is Barbara Smith-Warner. I represent House District 45, Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. Thank you for having me here today to talk to you about a really great, simple bill that we have passed through the House and are hoping to have the Senate join us and move it all the way through the process. So House Bill 2600, as you have briefly heard, will will make sure that an employee who is out on medical leave is able to keep their insurance coverage while that happens. Sounds pretty simple. Let me give you a little bit of background on why we are having to do this adjustment. So Oregon, as you probably know, has always been a national leader on family and medical leave. In 1987, we were one of the first states to pass parental leave. 1989, we added pregnancy disability to parental leave. And in 1991, Oregon passed our own FMLA, family medical leave. Our family medical leave was widely considered as a model for the National Family Medical Leave Act, which was passed in 1993. So once that national act was established, Oregon then repealed all of our previous leave laws to do the Oregon Family Leave Act in 1995. So then you had kind of parallel leaves between the Federal Family Medical Leave Act and the Oregon Federal Leave Act, Family Leave Act. So in many areas, when we did pass the Oregon legislation, Oregon made a conscious decision to provide more protections than in the federal law, like protections for sick child leave, which is not covered under the federal, and covering more employers than the federal Family Medical Leave Act. Specifically, the primary difference being that the Oregon Federal Leave Act covers employers of 25 employees or more, and federal is 50 or more. So the federal FMLA specifically prohibits employers from dropping health insurance coverage if it's something that they provide while an employee is out on protected leave, whereas Oregon federal leave does not have that line item in it. And as you can imagine, I can't think of a more important time for you to be able to keep your health insurance than when you're out on medical leave of some sort. So this bill would indeed bring Oregon into alignment with the federal standard and protect the continuation of group health insurance coverage of an employee while they are on Oregon family leave. This bill concept did come from a work group which had explored the differences in the two laws in an attempt to gain consistency. I hope that you will consider it as good of an idea as I did and pass it out of this committee into the floor.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Questions of the representative? Yes, Senator Knope.
I'm sorry, Representative, I missed your first part of your testimony. Oh. So were there any issues with people losing their health insurance coverage, any employers that were doing that precipitated the legislation? Or?
Sure. I would want to double check with the advocates. I'm not sure that it was that an incident provoked thing so much as it was an attempt to establish, to basically review where there were inconsistencies and reestablish them. So I don't know if it's appropriate for me to turn and ask an advocate that question.
We'll bring them up.
Yeah. So.
You'll have to wait.
Yes. But you seem like a patient man, Senator, so I'm
yes,
sorry.
Yes, let me put my glasses on. I look a lot more patient.
Any other questions of the representative? Okay, thanks a lot, Barbara.
Thank you.
Great. Okay, I'll call up Kate Newhall, and let's have Tricia Smith, too. You know, I think we can probably get name tags for these people who keep coming back, you know, nameplates.
They don't need them.
Time after time. Thank you, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, Kate Newhall here today again with Family Forward. We are happy to be here supporting House Bill 2600. And frankly, we see this as a technical fix to Oregon's law and something that no family should ever have to face is losing their health insurance while they're out on medical leave. To Senator Knope's question about if there have been instances that we're aware of, and I would say honestly, I'm not aware of any instances. I do think, though, it's an important protection to have in the law because you would never want to have a scenario where somebody really had their health insurance dropped while they were out on medical leave, and it's not currently in there. Another piece that I would point out is I think this is really applicable to a pretty small subset of employers. What we're talking about here is the universe of employers who are OFLA covered, but they're not FEMLA covered. So these are the employers that are 25 to 50, 49 employee size. So the employers that are over 50 employees are already covered by FEMLA, so they couldn't drop health insurance while somebody was out on medical leave. I think Representative Smith Warner did a really good job of giving sort of the overview of OFLA in Oregon, and I'll let Tricia talk about the legacy too, because it's fun. When I went back and read at one point a couple years ago, read all the history, it was fun to see Tricia Smith all throughout it. But I would encourage us to, I'm sorry, I can't help it. I would encourage us to continue to be a leader in OFLA and make sure that this is something that is aligned with FEMLA. I think it's something that you might hear in testimony that comes after me in opposition to this is instances where somebody could potentially get 36 weeks of leave. And I guess I'd just like to counter that in advance. It is a really, really rare circumstance where anybody could get 36 weeks of leave. And I call it actually sort of the trifecta situation. First of all, only a woman could do it. To get 36 weeks of leave, you would have to be put out on pregnancy disability leave for an entire 12 weeks. So that would mean that your doctor would say you would have to be on bed rest for 12 weeks. I don't know how often that comes up, but I think for the most part, things happen closer to the delivery date. It's not a full 12 weeks that we're talking about. So they'd have to have full 12 weeks of pregnancy disability leave. They would then have to take 12 weeks of new parental leave bonding. And in this instance, if they didn't take, and this is unpaid leave, right? So if they didn't take the full 12 weeks of parental bonding, they wouldn't get an additional 12 weeks. This is now, at this point, for this particular individual in this scenario, she's been out for 24 weeks of unpaid leave. I don't know of many people who can truly afford to then have an additional 12 weeks come after that. So if, for example, she couldn't take the full 12 weeks of parental leave, it wouldn't trigger that additional third 12 weeks. So I think it truly is a extremely rare circumstance that could happen. And I think if that does happen, that is absolutely the time in a person's life where they need to have their health insurance, and it should not be dropped, and they should never be put at that risk. So I think, again, we think that this is an oversight in OFLA and something that should definitely be corrected. We think it's fairly simple. I really honestly don't believe that there are a lot of employers out there who drop somebody's health insurance while they're out on leave, but what a horrific thing to do. So with that, I urge your support of House Bill 2600 and requiring that employees' medical coverage can't be discontinued while they're out on leave. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you very much. Senator Smith.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembro and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2600. I would hope that my involvement with this issue wouldn't color your feelings about House Bill 2600, because it is an excellent bill regardless of who supports it. But my purpose in testifying today, in addition to offering OSEA support for this bill, is to tell you that, as I know you know because you craft legislation, when you're crafting it, you try to think of every scenario that would come into play that would be affected by the legislation. And we tried to do that with the Oregon Family Medical Leave Act, and we missed because, frankly, it never occurred to us that an employer might cancel an employee's health insurance when that employee is out with a health crisis of some sort. And so we did not put that protection in the bill when it was originally crafted and passed, but we certainly would have had it occurred to us. And as Ms. Newhall said, we think that this is not, if it happens, it's certainly not a common situation, but one person that it could happen to is one person too many. And we think clarifying in the law that that is not an appropriate situation is a good thing for both employers and employees. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Tricia. Yes, Ms. Jett Thatcher.
Thank you. Do you know, have there been any estimates of how many people this might affect?
Chair Dembro, Senator Thatcher, I actually have that information on my laptop. I would be happy to email it. And so what I'll send you is the number of employers that are at the 25 to 49 threshold and then the number of employees that are at that threshold. And it's fairly recent from the Employment Department. I would say a couple months old.
Okay, thank you both. Senator Knope.
I just had a question for Tricia. So were you saying that this was your fault? you missed it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Knope, I will accept that responsibility, yes, sir.
That is, my fault. Is a heavy load to carry.
It is a heavy load, and I hope you will ease my burden.
We will take it under serious consideration because it's you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay, with that, thank you both very much. And Jael Wilson, Jan Meekums, and Betsy Earls, please. And you will all thank me for scheduling both these bills on the same day, right?
Yeah. Start with that. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, Betsy Earls appearing before you in opposition to House Bill 2600. And Tricia Smith is not the only person in this room that was here in this building when we negotiated the original family leave law, Oregon family leave law in whatever it was, 1995. I was here and worked on the bill too. And I remember some conversations around whether or not we would include a provision that employers couldn't drop their health insurance premium payments while an employee was on family leave. But what I remember about that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, is for the most part, the conversation about that had to do with the fact that employers typically write into their employment handbooks or their employment policies at the beginning of employment, whether or not that's a piece of the health insurance coverage that will continue to be covered when somebody's on family leave. So when we talked about it back in 1995, I would have to agree with Tricia. I don't think anybody contemplated employers unexpectedly dropping somebody from health insurance, and I'm still not – I've never actually heard of an employer having done that within our membership or anywhere else. So I'm not sure if I've heard that that's – particularly a problem around Oregon. But I would point out that, as has been mentioned, current federal medical leave law already requires employers of 50 or more to continue their payments on these health insurance premiums. So the big hit to employers will occur after the 12 weeks of FEMLA leave is over, because Oregon, as as Ms. Newhall did point out, can potentially extend to 36 weeks. So anywhere between 12 and 36 weeks is an increased requirement on employers of 50 or more. Also, the bill extends this requirement to smaller employers of between 25 and 50, and again could go anywhere from 0 weeks to, I suppose, eventually 36 weeks, although some number in between there is probably more common. I think many employers pay between 75 and 90% of the full premium for health insurance for their employees, depending, you know, in great part on the negotiated agreement they have with the employee, or what the offer was when the employee took the job, or the employee's status as a union member, an exempt employee, or whatever. So In round numbers, in today's health insurance, I think I'm pitching it low to say that we're looking at $800 to $1,000 per month for family or individual coverage per person on leave. So if you're an employer that has a couple of employees that are out on leave past the 12 weeks, and you're obligated to continue to pay this $800 to $1,000 a month in a situation where you had agreed at the beginning of the person's employment that that wasn't going to be something covered, that's not an insignificant hit. So I would not agree with the characterization that this is a technical fix. I think it's a technical fix only if you are not the employer that's having to pay the additional premium on the bill. And it's something that we've talked about in the past, and I would encourage you to not move the bill forward.
Thank you, Senator Dembrough, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jan Meekums, the State Director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. I won't repeat everything that's been said. We are in opposition to the bill, and albeit many of our members are less than 25 employees, we do have those that will fall into the 25 to 49 employee category. We have been surveying our members on a monthly basis since 1973, and consistently one of their biggest concerns is health care costs. And for those smaller employers that will now be added, this could, as has already been stated, can be a significant additional cost to them that they did not expect and would be difficult for them to bear. And with that, I'll leave it be with already what's been said and that we are in opposition of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, for the record, I'm J.L. Wilson representing the Oregon State Chamber of Commerce. There is one context, I think, where we would actually support the bill, and that is prior to the last interim, one of the things that we talked about as a consequence of the bill last session that included bereavement leave and folded it into the definition of OFLA is we wanted to take a look at all of the areas in which OFLA and FEMLA were inconsistent to try to remedy inconsistencies in the law and employers, you know, the biggest grind is when OFLA and FEMLA do not match up. And I agree that this provision is an area in which OFLA and FEMLA do not match up. Where I'm coming from on this issue, there's also a number of other areas that employers need where OFLA and FEMLA do not match up. If we were to talk about a bill in which we were matching up these things, there's return to work, reemployment provisions, doctor verification provisions, things that employers need that would align OFLA with FEMLA. I could reasonably see saying that this should be a part of this bill. But here we are today talking about just the one item that employers pay for, which I don't think is fair. The issue with regard to OFLA, and the important thing to remember is that the Oregon Family Leave Act applies to smaller employers. So we're contemplating that subset of smaller employers that's been talked about between 25 and 49 employees. But there are also different qualifying leaves under OFLA that are inconsistent with regard to definition of family members for whom care can be provided as a part of OFLA but not under FEMLA. You also have provisions of OFLA like sick child leave, which are not contemplated in any other state or in the federal law, but is a unique provision of the Oregon law, which you can take 12 weeks off for sick child leave. So there are different qualifying leaves under OFLA that are not available under FEMLA for which the provisions of House Bill 2600 would apply. You look at how an employer might respond to 2600, especially a small employer, 25 to 49, usually you're not just making do without that employee. Usually with that small of an employer, you're at least bringing in additional help to cover whatever work may not be being performed because the employee was out. And I think most employers will usually, and in fact, I think we've all kind of agreed that most employers will usually pay for the health insurance. But it is important to remember. I mean, a personal policy today is running about $575. A family policy is now up to about $1,250 a month. It is a significant expense, especially when you couple it with the prospect of bringing in someone else to cover the work of the employee who's out. So, I mean, that can add up. And although I would disagree with the practice of not providing the health insurance for somebody, I could also see situations of that small of an employer with tight cash flow that, you know, it might be a real hardship. And so, you know, again, I want to reiterate, as a standalone bill, I certainly don't support $2,600. If we talked about it in the context of a sort of a give and take on how we can align OFLA with FEMLA, I certainly think it's fair to add that as part of the mix, and I'll just put that on the record.
Thank you. Thanks for your candor, Jail. In my experience, when people are brought in temporarily just for, you know, a few weeks or, you know, a couple months, they don't get health insurance, employer-paid health insurance. Am I saying things wrong?
Thank you, Chair Dambro. It all depends. I mean, sometimes you do it because it's your policy to do it, and in some cases you're right, it doesn't happen. But at the very least, you know, you are at least paying the wages and the workers' comp and the UI and all the attendant, you know, benefits that accompany that employment.
But you're not paying for the person who's out. Right.
Correct. Definitely. You're not paying the person who's out with the exception.
So you're still just paying for one employee.
Correct.
And probably in most cases just for one set of, you know, one health premium. I know there may be some exceptions to that, but I think that is generally the case.
Yeah. I mean, I don't dispute that characterization. It can take many forms, though, you know.
Any questions? Okay. Thank you. Thank you all. Okay, with that, I'll close our public hearing on House Bill 2600. And again, colleagues, we have run out of issues for the day. So unless anyone has anything else that they want us to address or to solve, we're adjourned.